somewhere in that stack of paperwork you signed on your first day, there's a paragraph that says you can't compete with your firm after you leave. For a lot of capable advisors, that single paragraph is the reason they never seriously look at their options. Today, I want to walk through what actually decides whether a non-compete is enforceable, and the clauses in that same agreement that often bind harder than the non-compete does. Quick note before we get into it, Advisor Growth Lab is not a broker-dealer, and everything here is for educational purposes only. It's not individualized legal, tax, or investment advice. Every advisor's situation is different, so treat this as a map, not a set of directions. If you've ever wondered whether the restriction you signed would actually hold up, this episode is for you. We'll cover the questions courts actually ask. Why your state matters more than your signature. The difference between a non-compete and a non-solicit. And the restraints nobody calls a non-compete that do most of the restraining. Start with the question most advisors never say out loud. Is the clause valid just because I signed it? No. When these clauses get tested, courts generally weigh whether the restriction is reasonable, and the analysis tends to circle three things. How long does it last, months or years? How much ground does it cover, your branch's neighborhood, or the whole country? And how badly does it cut into your ability to earn a living in the profession you trained for? A restriction that flunks those questions doesn't automatically get enforced as written. In some states, a court can trim an overbroad clause down to something defensible and enforce the trimmed version. In others, overbreadth can sink the clause entirely. So read that intimidating paragraph for what it is, an opening argument, not a verdict. A firm drafting a non-compete writes it as broadly as it dares, precisely because most people who sign one will never ask whether it holds up. Now, why does your state matter so much? Because non-compete law in this country is mostly state law, and the differences are not subtle. California is the famous example of a state that has long declined to enforce most employment non-competes. Other states enforce restrictions they consider reasonable, and a big middle group applies its own tests, statutes, and case law. The same clause, word for word, can be dead on arrival in one state and enforceable in the next. Two wrinkles make it messier. Your contract probably names a particular state's law, often the state where your firm is headquartered rather than where you sit, and courts don't always honor that choice. And the forum matters. Advisor disputes frequently land in FINRA arbitration, the industry's arbitration system, while a firm trying to stop a departing advisor fast may go to court first for emergency relief. On top of all that, the ground has been shifting. In 2024, the Federal Trade Commission, the FTC, finalized a rule aimed at banning most non-competes. Courts blocked it before it took effect nationwide. And as of right now, there is no federal ban in force. Where that goes from here is genuinely uncertain, and anyone who tells you confidently how it ends is guessing. Next distinction, and this one changes the whole picture for a lot of people. A non-compete limits where you can work. A non-solicit limits whom you can contact. They're different promises with different weight, and advisors tangle them together constantly. Plenty of advisors who believe they're locked out of the industry are actually carrying the narrower promise. A non-solicit doesn't stop you from working across the street. It constrains how you go about contacting the clients you left behind. And even then, the line between prohibited solicitation and permitted conduct, like an announcement or a client who calls you first, depends on your state and your facts. This is also where the broker protocol comes in. The protocol, created back in 2004 by Smith Barney, Merrill Lynch, and UBS, is a voluntary agreement covering what client information a departing advisor can take when moving between two member firms. The official protocol text spells out five fields: client name, address, phone number, email address, and account title. It answers the client data question. It is not a shield against everything else in your agreement, and whether it covers your move at all depends on both firms being members, which leads to the restraints that never get called non-competes and often hold tighter than one. The first is garden leave. Some agreements require a notice period before your departure takes effect, and during that period, you typically remain an employee, often still paid, while being kept away from clients and sometimes the office. The firm gets a built-in head start on solidifying those relationships without ever needing to convince a court that a non-compete is reasonable. The second is the money. Unvested, deferred compensation, and recruiting loans that haven't finished forgiving. FINRA itself has described recruitment incentives running as much as 2 to 3 times the prior year's commissions and fees, and its guidance walks through an illustrative 9-year note. An advisor can hold a non-compete. A court would never enforce and still be anchored to the desk by a vesting schedule. But notice something about the handcuffs. Vesting dates are knowable. Note balances are knowable. Advisors who map them out sometimes find the binding is looser or the timing better than the dread suggested. Knowing beats assuming. So why do most non-competes never get tested? Because fear does the work the clause never could. Most advisors never have their agreement examined at all. They assume the worst case reading and stay put. And at that point, the firm's drafting has done its job regardless of what a court would say. Meanwhile, the industry keeps moving. Fidelity's advisor movement study found more than half of advisors considered switching firms within a 5-year window, and roughly 1 in 4 actually moved. Diamond Consultants' annual transition report counted more than 11,000 experienced advisors changing firms in 2025, up about 16% from the year before. Advisors with restrictions in their contracts move all the time. What separates the ones who move cleanly is rarely a friendlier contract. It's that they found out what their contract actually said under their actual state's law before they acted. None of that means your clause is toothless, and none of it is permission. Firms do enforce these, sometimes aggressively, and the first days after a resignation are exactly when a firm that believes a line was crossed goes looking for emergency relief. One more point before I wrap up. This whole question, your clause, your state, your facts, is a job for a securities attorney. Most advisors don't have one on call, and that's the point. Get the right specialist in your corner well before anything like a resignation letter exists. An hour of reading now beats a courtroom argument later. If you want to get clear on where you stand before you talk to anyone, we built a short assessment for exactly this, 6 questions, and it routes you to a private conversation or the research that fits your situation. It's free on our website at advisorgrowthlab.com. Nobody gets notified. It's just a starting point. Find out what you actually signed before you let it decide anything. Clear eyes first, the move second. I'll see you tomorrow.